Hello, creeps. I'll be your ghost. I mean host. As we delve the crypts of spooky movies and even spookier theory, welcome to Horror Vanguard.
You gotta keep each other on your toes, like the starter's pistol, much like a starter's pistol, you know.
in a movie that has no metaphors.
Yeah, much like the beginning of the 200 meter freestyle. You gotta be ready. You need a good, clean entry into the discourse. Remember to breathe, everybody.
I mean, if you're a millisecond behind on your takes, that can be the difference between your scholarship to the Horror Vanguard Swimming Academy. That's been our secret all these years, is we're actually a podcast about competitive swimming, and all the horror stuff has been kind of a metaphor.
Yeah, it's always been a metaphor for collegiate level sports. And if you haven't picked up on that after some 300 episodes, that's on you. That's on you, yeah, to be honest.
We're not Marxists. It's all just coded references to college football and swimming and baseball. And I'm assuming there are other sports.
Yeah, if you play every episode of Horror Vanguard backwards, it's just the Gipper speech that Ronald Reagan gives in that fucking 40s movie.
Oh, and today we're going to do it for the Gipper here at Horror Vanguard. I am one of your hosts, Ashley Darrow. I am wearing my olive cargo capris and orange sweater. I am joined, as always, by John, aka the Liquor Guy, who dressed as an entire crawl space for today's episode. How's it going, John?
Yeah, normally I wear my now outlawed Neosporin all-in-one bathing suit / podcasting outfit, because I feel like it reduces drag. But the International Podcasting Commission have changed the rules. And so, unfortunately, I waxed all of my body hair for nothing today. So.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I'm... And today we're joined by an alligator, if you will, a frequent lurker in the crawl space that is Horror Vanguard. The one, the only, you know him as Labor Kyle. Kyle Kern, applause. The kind of applause that you would hear in the perfect acoustics of a college pool.
Yeah, if you could just play the instrumental to Nookie underneath all of that for me. Yeah, the Floridian is here. I'm just remembering now that one of my first childhood dreams that I ever remember was I was at this pool party, and precariously placed right next to this pool full of children was a giant tank filled with pink and blue sharks.
Sick.
And the tank eventually broke, and then the gender sharks attacked everybody.
How did you have a dream about Blaha so many years in advance?
I like that I have been recording audio for about 4 minutes, and we've already arrived at like dream analysis.
when it jumps out at you, you're supposed to try and grasp
Carl Jung the alligator in the crawl space of our discussion?
No, I'm of course always happy to be back and happy to be home. I am for no reason precariously filling the HV crypt with various reptiles in a steady stream of water. But the most important part is that it's not a metaphor for anything.
No.
It's just for fun. But no, I'm happy to be here. I love Horror Vanguard. And I watched a movie about alligators and have a group chat with the two of you. So that's what happened. And now we're here.
Because sometimes when people care about each other very much, what they'll do is they will all get all cool and make a podcast together. And it's beautiful and it's natural. And don't let anybody tell you any different.
That's right.
And we're so happy to have you back in our longstanding family home, even if your times in the collegiate swimming competition are a little disappointing.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, I got here 0.200th of a second later than everyone else when the Discord call started, and I'm afraid that it might affect my scholarship to the HV Academy of Swimming / Drowning. Drowned ghouls and such.
But swimming / advanced Marxist film analysis. The very common college combo.
It's extremely common. Everybody does that. As our official...
The pink and blue sharks of collegiate education.
As our official Florida mascot. Kyle is back. I am honestly delighted that now me and Kyle get to hear live, as Ash explains, that it isn't a metaphor. It's not a metaphor. There are no visual metaphors operating at all in 2019's Sam Raimi produced film, Crawl.
Most crocodiles and alligators look very similar. But there is only one relatively new problem.
Supermarkets.
I spent an odd portion of my childhood in crawl spaces, perhaps more so than most. The crawl space has been something of a third place in my life. I grew up in a rickety trailer that had its front hitch busted off. The thin sheets of aluminum that stood for its walls barely kept the outside world at bay. Within the dark confines of the crawl space, however, the protection offered by corrugated sheet metal amounts to nothing more than peace of mind. As the oldest sibling, but still small and wiry enough to slink through cavernous spaces, it was within my remit to investigate and resolve minor problems beneath the trailer. My father would pull open the access panel and I'd crawl in with little more than a flashlight. I was warmed, oddly enough, by the similarity to the dank underside of the memories of my childhood home and the titular crawl space in today's movie. The mud, random wires, which you could never be certain weren't carrying a charge, cinder blocks, splitting supports, spiders, and strange wildlife lurking in the mire. It was all a little picture of home. I never went into the crawlspace of my own volition. I was conscripted into the job, much like Haley, by the demands of the moment. I'd sit down there with a blow dryer trying to unfreeze the pipes and let my mind wander to distract myself from the gnawing discomfort that crept over every inch of my skin. Years later, in my early teens, I won my first computer from the jaws of a crawlspace. My family chanced to move into a house, and though our stay there would be less than a year, the crawlspace was loaded with the possessions of a previous tenant. I raided this long-forgotten storehouse and found little of interest save an old computer. It was an artifact from a more civilized age running Windows 98. Through that computer, I first began to build my love of writing. I'd stay up long hours hammering the keys as I penned TTRPG campaigns, Legend of Zelda fanfic, and poetry I'm honestly thankful I can't recall a line of. As I've grown older, the crawl space has become an infrequent friend. A landlord will neglect a friend's repairs, leaving the task to me, a cat will get caught under a house, and dangerous weather will lead to desperate solutions. Small moments of my history dissolving in the shadows of a crawl space. A crawl space is less than a place, it's an artifact. And like all artifacts, it's made worthy of excavation by our sharing in its history. Join us as we discuss Crawl.
Yes. Yes, 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 yes.
Crawl.
At the top of my doc, I, in contrast to what Ash just did, I wrote, oops, all gators.
Just honestly, I should have just said that.
Is my summary. That's my summary of the movie.
I mean, really, those two are in so many ways saying exactly the same thing.
I thought about writing the Precy through my like personal like autobiographical historic connection to randomly encountering a bunch of gators out of circumstances you usually wouldn't. But it was either that or crawl spaces, you know, and take your pick. A gator or a crawl space are pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, I was considering bringing that up, Ash, because you've made casual mention to this before, and I think on purpose, because I knew that we were going to talk about this movie, I did not ask for further elaboration, though I am generally curious about your relationship with random gators.
Yeah.
Is the random collections.
I can think of no better
place. This
movie
is really the random...
Can we hear this story?
This is the random collection of gators, the movie. So tell us about the source material.
In Florida, an alligator mother away from her eggs is being called to the nest by the sound of the hatchlings. Cries from both inside the eggs and from emerging youngsters summon her to their aid and protection.
So yeah,
an orange Home Depot bucket, I'm assuming. Did you know that orange is one of the colors of the University of Florida, who are called the Gators?
Taking us right back in.
Well,
I'm repping orange today in support for my favorite Florida State University mascot, Sam Raimi.
Yeah. I think as Kyle is our official Floridian correspondent, maybe as we dive in to the formalism zone, Kyle, can you maybe explain how you see this film fitting into the broader canon of Florida cinema?
Sure. Yeah, I think Crawl is like, gosh, it's hard to find one place to start because it has this, all of these like of your favorite kind of strange, imperfect, like horror movies. They offer this kind of like composite image of various ideas pulled from the, you know, I mean, this is filmmaking in general, but horror takes on this extra dimension through these kind of like, you know, encounters with the strange, uncanny, the foreign, the idea of what the, if there were too many gators in one place, as a theoretical question that doesn't just impose itself on the idea of the film being set in Florida, because gator horror, as I'm calling it now, comes from a variety of places, and also that makes very little distinction oftentimes besides in setting between what a crocodile and an alligator is, which is another thing that I really like about it. Who cares? Big lizards is a great policy to have to sort of frame your film project around, because it shows that you're not adhering to the sort of necessary restraints that come with certain kinds of contemporary art, especially, and instead just get to kind of cut loose with it. So I guess the idea, there's the setting in the context serve to illustrate this kind of, you know, the, you know, to say that, you know, the to take the bit, the wide angle first, is that there is a Florida connection, this constellation, if you will, to use my favorite historical term, built throughout a lot of episodes of Horror Vanguard at this point. We've gone through movies filmed in Florida, but presumably set somewhere else, like 2000 Maniacs, made by famous Floridians. We've, in like even outside of episodes of Horror Vanguard, John and I presented at a conference, and I presented a paper on the writer Harry Cruz, who is a very famous kind of Florida writer who writes horror and these very sort of like chaotic, violent stories. Based off of his childhood in Georgia, but then he moved to Florida and lived out most of his life teaching at the University of Florida, for example. So there's all these like really kind of rich connections between this idea of the place where I grew up. And I make a lot of jokes about it in all platforms and this one too. But like, despite living in other places, I've spent the vast majority of my life in Florida, and I'm interested in helping people grasp a more complex idea of what it is as a place, which is a tension between, on the one hand, its actual complexity, when it's usually characterized in popular consciousness with this characterized, if you will, in popular consciousness and thought of in culture. It is this kind of like culture, and the way that people talk about it has this kind of extractive quality when it comes to Florida, right? It's very voyeuristic. And there are filmmakers who are guilty of doing that, who kind of like coming in and like getting kind of enraptured by its myth making. But I think that actually is a sort of a powerful testament. Like, if California can fucking do that, why can't Florida do that? Mm-hmm. It's elitist, like, to say that like there isn't this sort of feeling that you get when you encounter places in Florida and places like it. And it's such a big state, and it just shows that like everyone who makes a Florida movie, from the most sort of like, you know, I'm just loaded sort of postmodern, removed, mm-hmm. arguably cynical in some ways perspective, like someone like Harmony Korine in Spring Breakers, which I think is a very good movie, yeah. for the record. I liked Spring Breakers quite a bit. There's that perspective on the one hand. And then there's this sort of like still like mythic element present in the source material, as well as the film adaptation of things like something like Cool Hand Luke, which I've always found to have this kind of like, I'm interested in very contemporary, as in engaging with the social consequences of the contemporary depictions of the type of history that feels almost universal throughout history,
yeah.
which often becomes this kind of like, you know, depiction of a great heroic individual. It's also easy for filmmaking or whatever. But in the case of something like Cool Hand Luke, it is adapted from a memoir that is doing its own sort of heroism and myth making. And then in the encounter with sort of this an encounter with the open air prison, which gives you this kind of like weird encounter with space, it sort of sucks the environment into the story in a way that I find really interesting. Mm. And so if a movie can do this, like all of the movies that are set in Florida or talk about, Color Me Blood Red is another really good example, one that we yes. talked about, that is Herschel Gordon Lewis is just like another sort of really captures the imagination of Florida as a place in a way that I find actually very compelling. And that really effectively mediates this relationship, this sort of like voyeuristic image, which is a part of the way that the cultural imagination looks at Florida. And then Florida in some ways sort of like affirms that through the continuation of its sort of social sphere. I'm very, very like vulgarly Marxist in my sort of like literary perspective here is kind of the point, is that that imagination is depicted and then interpreted and is undergirded by this social reality that has, you know, all these films are, you know, films that are about, you know, Spring Breakers for an example, it takes this voyeuristic perspective and places this kind of like, it's an encounter. It's representative of Harmony Korine's encounter with South St. Pete, which is kind of close to where I grew up. You know, which also means that we've made our way up and down the coast of basically where I grew up at this point. We've done central Florida, and then we've done the central Florida Gulf Coast, which is like, I grew up in between those two spaces. But it has this like, you know, Florida's never going to be represented perfectly, he says, until he watches a movie from 2019 about a nest of killer gators that just kind of, or not even killer gators, it's complicated, we'll talk about it, but that blows in because of a hurricane. And I've been through a lot of hurricanes in my life. I have a lot of hurricane knowledge. It has like local they say the word hurricane party in there. I perked mm-hmm. up so bad because that is like in the Florida lexicon, the idea we're going to have a hurricane party, which means like if things aren't that, so oftentimes the entire state of Florida experiences a hurricane, but it doesn't hit everywhere. Right. So you have to like shelter in place and be safe and do all of this stuff, while sometimes it just doesn't really, like it rains really hard all day or there's wind or whatever. So you go over to one another's houses or whatever and have a hurricane party. Just that enough, I was just on board. I'm like, yeah, Florida, good Florida movie. Put it in the good Florida movie bin. And yeah, so like, I think that's the point. I think that's why I wanted to talk about it and why I proposed it is because on the one hand, it has such a like all the movies that we've talked about that are centered around the place where I grew up. It's on the one hand, so particular because it's just kind of a unique place and you can see it's the evidence of itself pop up all over in the setting or in the people who made it or whatever. It takes this sort of like multi-dimensional kind of shape. And then on the other hand, it's also kind of the birds. So you can, you know, talk about the fictionalizing of the shattering of the coordinates of our reality or whatever the fuck Zizek said. and really, it's also Chariots of Fire. Really, it's kind of, yeah, it's really at the end of the day, it's a movie about, believing in yourself.
That's what I think of every time I look at an alligator. I just get like, I can fucking do it.
Yeah. If you want to overcome imposter syndrome, like apex predator all day, baby. That's my favorite line in the entire film. Yes.
We'll get into that line later. I love that line too because it just so cleanly subverts all of the like alpha lone wolf like discursive mentalities that pop up through our culture. Like it plays with that so in a way that's just like so fun.
I feel like we should flag up though that like even though this is a good Florida movie, this is a movie that's made in Serbia. The lead actor who plays Haley is British. It's directed by a French guy. Like, really, what we're saying is like Florida is like a vibe.
It's a composite of a bunch of other bullshit. It always is, always has been.
Yeah, yeah.
It's this mishmash of like no one knows what to do with it. And yeah, represented by just like, you know, Jimmy Buffett's from Mississippi.
Yeah, precisely.
Like what? Like, or Alabama? I think Mississippi. Like, you know, yeah. No, I think that's an important thing to point out.
In Florida, Florida has that kind of like long state problem, much like Illinois, where you've got the like,
yeah,
kind of urban economic centers, and then you've got places like Oswego. You know, you've got mm-hmm. these like voids in Tolomo and stuff, where it's just like, if Illinois had alligators, that's where they'd be found.
Yeah, the kind of place where you say you're from that part of Illinois and people say, oh, so you mean Indiana or Missouri?
Yeah, pretty much.
It's like, no, but also kind of.
Yeah, you're from Chicago or you're from Illinois.
Yeah.
But this isn't an Illinois movie.
How do we feel then about this as like a creature feature? Like, how nice is it to see a decent creature feature like made in 5 years ago? This is amazing.
I love it. And I love how this is kind of like we're still, I think, in a very long arc of rationalist fantasy cinema, you know, including horror, where everything is just explained to death and it's given so many rules. And this is like, no, like the alligators are sometimes fucking gigantic and bigger than a car. Maybe the alligator then gets small enough to crawl through a drain pipe and then gets really big again. And like sometimes they're tired and sometimes they can hear and sometimes they can't and who the fuck knows, they're just everywhere and spooky. Like they're this is Alien in a crawl space.
So Alien then.
But this is a movie set in a decaying architectural zone that's poorly lit, full of slime, with a monster that's kind of reptilian with a poor set of rules, and it's all about gender. So it's either Alien or Crawl. Alligators are an interesting choice, too. There's not a lot of, like, I mean, like, obviously, listeners, there's Replicator. And I want to thank you, Kyle, so much for breaking the alligator seal, because you have consigned your mortal soul to return to the show to discuss 1998's Replicator, the movie about a Floridian government scientist who turns bimbo babes into alligator babes. And then if those alligator babes bite a dude, that dude turns into a gay zombie. So we're going to have a lot of fun discussing that.
If you can hear me in the background, I'm furiously typing because I'm not familiar with this.
A Replicator is such a good movie that it doesn't even have a Wikipedia page.
Oh, yeah, yeah, baby. Yeah, sorry. I just looked. I'm sorry to the listeners who can't see my computer screen. I just looked it up.
Oh, I forgot. This so sounds the awesome. The thing in Replicator is if you come, you get turned into an alligator. forget about that. Forget about the icing on the cake there.
So it's another horror movie about semen retention. God, another one.
Oh my god.
Yeah,
oh,
jizz maxing.
Oh dear. I was trying to cook up a no nut November alligator joke in my head, but really I couldn't make those work. Listeners, if you can make that work, please don't let us know.
Yeah, we can't do everything for you. Come on. God, no, enjoy editing this one.
Yeah, this is gonna be interesting.
I was gonna leave it all in.
The choice of gators is perfect. It's so on the nose as to be made ridiculous, but then it just decides that it's going to be kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Right, it's also going to take itself very seriously in a way that, like, I'm so glad that this isn't a horror comedy.
Yes.
It would take all of the sort of, like, you know, all of this sort of like fringed edge stuff,
mm-hmm.
just completely out of it.
It would be stop so edging. Just as you
yeah, no more edging. it's just as you said, Ash, the kind of like explain the hell out of everything moment that we find ourselves in is contrasted perfectly by the scene where after hiding behind a couple of pipes, but still completely submerged in water, though the gators can't get there.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason. Oh, we lost John.
Oh,
we got him back.
The gators got John, listeners. No. But it looks like John is slowly crawling his way back to the area of the HV crypt that has a bunch of plumbing. John, you've made it back to the wet wall. Good. Whew, we were worried there for a second.
I lost my leg, but don't worry about it. I'm fine.
That's not one of the few podcasting limbs, so you're all right.
Yeah, I just wrapped my mic cable around it as a tourniquet, and we never need to mention this again.
Okay.
But you lost your phone.
The three of us, whom amongst us has had and has operated a hand crank flashlight? Because that brought back so many memories for me. That is like mandatory tornado equipment, the hand crank flashlight. Yeah. I was just like, oh, my heart.
Yeah, it's your hurricane box or whatever. You got a... one of those and a hand cranked radio, mm-hmm. and a
lot of
Band-Aids for some reason. Yeah. Really, this is a movie about cranking.
Edging, cranking, No Nut November. We're learning a lot of very important things today about 2019 Skrull. Mm-hmm. I do think the alligator is an interesting choice for a monster, though, because we have... in kind of like the American cultural imagination, we have like this really long literary tradition of the woods being this kind of center of this like devil ridden gothic terror and the kind of animals that live out in the wild. Right. But in our contemporary moment, like that we have killed and chained away the threatening elements of nature. And I think the gator is the weird exception to this in a small way. Like I see like so many news articles where it's like, look at this goofy bear that locked itself in a dumpster because it's silly. And then I see a lot of news articles where it's like, horrifying demon alligator seen on golf course, residents praying for relief. So I think there is something interesting that the alligator is still a source of fear when even the bear has been kind of tamed in the imagination.
So
not discounting the presence of Lyle the crocodile.
I mean, it goes without saying, but two reasons why I think this is, which is like, firstly... it's about where does humanity meet the alligator? And the alligator is like not like if you take a very normative, naturalized approach, the alligator is not like native to what we would stereotypically call a human environment. Humans have to invade the alligator's environment for them to be a real problem. solidarity with the alligator that invades any always. Floridian golf course. Like, Godspeed, you strong soldier of nature.
turn the golf course into a public sex forest and or alligator reserve.
Both. What could go wrong?
Also, honorable mention to Schnappi, Das Kleines Krokodil. We're just shouting out all the alligators we know today. And we personally know Schnappi here.
I think there is something to be said, though, for like, there is this idea that like reptiles generally don't have a consciousness that is like comparable, or like it can be anthropomorphized. Like pretty much any other like big creature, you can go, oh, like even a bear is like genealogically, you can be like, oh, mm-hmm. It's a cute teddy bear.
It's still mammalian.
Yeah, it's mammalian, but like because it's reptilian, I don't know. I think there's something about our kind of very, very expansionist drive to anthropomorphize, to make nature to be like us and not respect its fundamental strangeness. That's why reptiles are still scary. You can't easily domesticate a reptile.
Those are powerful sentiments about the Cardassians as we enter the new segment of our show, the Herpetology Zone. And the obligatory Star Trek references. We're just doing all the hits today. We just always have so much energy when Kyle comes back home.
I couldn't be more honored to have that effect. This completely, bonkers, I think is the word. The bonkers effect on Horror Vanguard.
It's the embonkification, I believe.
The embonk, yeah.
The embonkification.
That can only happen when Kay's here too, because that's when everything just goes off, though.
It goes off the rails.
It can only happen when AGAB is fully present.
This podcast does have strong Florida energy. Anything can happen.
Yep.
And listeners, go listen to AGAB. It's a wonderful it's not only a wonderful podcast about video games, it's also the only podcast about video games.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's been proven by the Guinness people.
Yeah, science.
It's in there. Yeah, and science.
Science.
Mansa confirmed this, yeah.
And the cultural Marxist conspiracy theory proved it as well. But AGAB is the only video game podcast.
I believe the Florida State swim team also independently confirmed these results, so it is across the board true.
Yeah, that's right. The researchers who worked on the AGAB confirmation project were, in fact, from the University of Florida. As well as my alma mater, the University of South Florida, always making y'all look good by talking about dicks. The Gators are awesome. John, you're definitely right about the sort of like the Gator as this kind of like very almost 19th century Jacksonian metaphor for contemporary encounters with the untamed wilds, you know, like this. They don't like horses and bulls and stuff, speaking of the University of South Florida, settle into this sort of like taming process of the imagined and the actual frontier or whatever, but you can't put a gator on a leash unless you're in Red Dead Redemption 2. So you have this kind of, again, a tension that's not easily explained away by other kinds of cultural metaphors.
Yeah.
I think definitely that there's the movie that this is the kind of, this is like the bright side of the, this is one side of this certain type of film that I see. This is the bright inverse to the movie Run, Hide, Fight that was made and produced by Ben Shapiro's people or whatever.
Yeah.
So it First obvious question, Kyle, have you seen this movie? Of course I've seen this movie. I watched it right when it came out because I was interested mostly for a number of reasons. At the very least, you'll cringe at it, but at the most, you'll get some sort of glimpse into the production of this higher end production of conservative culture, which is something that I'm always interested in. And Run, Hide, Fight is in this. It's for people who aren't familiar with it. It's made by the Ben Shapiro people. The production of it was really, really terrible and horrific for everyone involved besides the director who was doing most of the terrorizing. And it's a movie. It's basically a like stylized in the films your dad watches school shooter, like vigilante rescue film starring the girl from 1883, another show your parents like, wow. the Taylor Sheridan Yellowstone Universe prequel series, which 1883 is the best one out of all of them for sure. She stars in it. Isabel May is her name. She's like 20 years old. She's great. She's good in pretty much everything she's in. But Run, Hide, Fight is actually shocker. In a lot of ways, a metaphor for the relationship between a father, the strained relationship between a father and his daughter. Run, Hide, Fight solves this, like works through this in the more typical conservative metaphors of like individual, of affirming the necessary hard decisions, usually violent ones, needed to be made by righteous singular agents in times of great crisis. Again, see the things that your dad watches. It gives you really like all you have to do is watch the TV and movies your dad watch even a little bit and you get an idea into an incredibly popular sort of psychic configuration for a lot of people in the United States. Mm-hmm. The way that it sort of is imagined in the kind of culture that they like. The thing about Run, Hide, Fight is that it uses this father-daughter relationship in some ways to kind of almost very gently, but effectively in some ways, in my opinion, to like this kind of soft handling of playing around with more traditional family constructions by making it about this like sort of equalizing relationship between a father and a daughter that used to be probably more stereotypically between fathers and sons. Mm-hmm. But it philosophically coheres in this like actually I think more fully realized, at least not hypocritical way, to where indeed yes, your daughter can be the radical individual who through your influence and despite your flaws and her flaws makes the tough, usually violent decisions in times of crisis. So it has this kind of, it has the like sort of vision of a more contemporary interpretation of what are, again, probably just everything to me is 19th century Jacksonian masculinity, but I'm sure it's more complicated than that. But just kind of like the popular idea of like what it means to be a person in the United States is in a lot of ways indebted to this very political imagination of the relationships between members of families. Crawl does like a lot of the same stuff, but reimagines it in a social context that's not indebted to, in the case of Run, Hide, Fight, just a very contentious social issue that's interpreted and weaponized through like right-wing cultural propaganda most of the time. And instead leans on this these naturalistic metaphors as a way for bringing in so much more of the actual results of the actual what it's actually like to live in Florida, and the actual results of development in Florida, the way that industry has, so like gator attacks aren't that common. Mm-hmm. They are increasing over like a long period, over like a period of 10 years or whatever. Gator bites and fatal gator attacks, they're brutal and they're terrible, and that's part of the reason why I think they can sort of like invoke fear in me, gators. Mm. Like I'm afraid of gators. They pose a threat mostly to children and elderly people. And like what's they vulnerable people, they attack people's dogs and stuff, you know, like, and when people try and rescue their dogs, they get attacked too. And that kind of a thing. It's really, it's awful stuff to read about. And then, but you place them in conversation with the relationship between human impact on the environment, development, or whatever. And the natural step to this, what Crawl does perfectly, is puts it all within the context of a hurricane. The thing that we have, through various discursive formations present in the way that we interpret natural disasters, we're more focused on the impact to, often most focused on the impact to private industry through sensationalized depictions of quote unquote looting on television and things like this. This is what remains relevant in cultural memory. Yet natural disasters are like, show us, as hurricanes especially, show us the impact of the quote unquote, sort of like the impact of the impact across the binary between the sort of industrial human world and the natural world, because the people who die in hurricanes are homeless people, mm-hmm. and elderly people who need electricity, or who get, like, the problems that people who in, like, the elder care industry in Florida is one of the most evil things in the entire United mm-hmm. States. And the amount of people who die in elder care because of evil, absolutely profoundly evil, corporate interests that, like, treat people horribly, it would, like, astonish you. So the way that Crawl sort of subverts this idea of, you know, brings this sort of, like, personal narrative out into the environment relies so much more on what's, like, profoundly true about the reality of having to live in a place that has been affected by the kind of people who run Florida, or demons, fucking demons.
Yes.
Rather than rely on easy cultural, easy repackaging of the cultural imaginary instead. It's a good movie.
There's so much in what you've said, and I think we have to... Mm-hmm. Like, we've got to talk about like family discourses of gender in this, but, like, I think all of those are expressions of, or modalities of, the fundamental class antagonisms and class relationships of living in Florida, and why, like, the questions of, like, why Florida is increasingly seeing, like, numbers of gator bites, why natural disasters are going to hit certain communities in Florida harder than others, like, just the basic question of, like, why is this nice girl able to just drive past the police in her four-wheel drive car, because she just needs to go check on her dad, and they just go, yeah, all right.
We better check on her later.
Yeah, it's it's fine. I'm sure. Like, this makes me sound very... I never feel more non-American than when I see films which spend a lot of time in American homes. Because American houses are so, so big. Like, American houses are enormous, especially by the standards of the UK. Obviously, it's mm-hmm. it's a space thing. It's a land thing. But it's also, like... how many of these houses are, like, debt financed and debt leveraged and mortgaged to the hilt, and home repair is something that you do simply because if you don't, you have to pay someone to do it. So, like, all of these things of, like, familial obligation, and what does Florida represent in this hierarchy of class relationships? You know, who is Florida for, right, is, I think, a really important question in this.
Oh, I love that question.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if, like, and you brought this up earlier, Kyle, and I think we should maybe talk about this, because I think this is a really good, like, snapshot in the film, is our moment where we see the quote unquote looters outside.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to know what you both think about that in the context of this film's, like, class dynamics.
I guess I'll set up the conversation in context with our movie, which it's not that this film doesn't have any metaphors. It's that the metaphors are just, like, so beautifully open. And so as Haley is driving down to go check in on her dad in this Floridian hurricane, we in the audience are treated to a little bit of you know, like building our setting through some AM radio, which tells us a lot about Haley's character that she's like willingly listening to AM radio. I guess that's like a hurricane thing, looking for weather updates, but still. And we get like two radio announcers, and the first group of radio announcers are talking about the Second Amendment and guns, and they live in Florida because of its conservative laws, specifically around guns and gun culture. And then we get another radio broadcast, which I think is the same host, although I don't think it's confirmed by the movie. And they're talking about like, you know, like, oh, if you have to go protect your family, like, you know, like they were just talking about oh my God, hang on.
So this time we've tried to do it a little more scientifically by putting a barrier right across the enclosure, right through the pond.
Oh, there's a gator in my throat. In the crawl space of my throat, there is an alligator. But the radio announcers were talking about how Florida has, like, castle doctrine and stand your ground laws and how that makes the state great. And then they rounded out with, like, you know, like, our hearts go out to all the families who are just trying to protect their children against this unforeseeable, entirely unmitigatable, completely out of nowhere event that is a hurricane, which happens on a regular basis and is very predictable. And I think that sets up the appearance of the looters nicely, because we are treated to kind of the, I guess, like the internal confliction that kind of like politically conservative mentality necessarily has to juggle before we're introduced to people trying to like get money and snacks from a gas station in a flood.
Yeah, there's a like the almost entire cultural apparatus around natural disasters is indebted to this image of looting. Mm-hmm. And it's something that's borrowed from other depictions of crowds and other instances of private enterprise being intervened upon by an active party. And thus there's some sort of like, you need to sort of like recuperate the even though you know, like all of this stuff that's insured and what can ultimately be replaced, unlike human life or whatever, needs to be sort of, its fragility needs to be recuperated through an antagonistic position toward the looter as a descriptive category, as a sort of category of individual contra to the particular necessities of a state apparatus.
I mean, it's no coincidence, right? It's no coincidence that this discourse of like the looter as a figure in the American cultural imagination is so deeply embedded, thanks to Hurricane Katrina specifically, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. And was the Katrina and New Orleans in particular, but really the entire coastal border of the southeastern portion of the United States was sort of brought into you see these competing just exactly like the radio described, these sort of like competing imagination of, on the one hand, the effect to a certain type of a person, usually a rural white person, and then on the other hand the actions and sort of the actions that inform the description of an can we say urban individual characterize this, like it all exists between this sort of very racialized, very urban rural divide, which again just kind of falls along the lines of race in the United States. Like competing images between the kind of the relief, the necessary relief and intervention of on behalf of people who need help after a storm, and then the black looter, basically. Yeah. And that tension informs so much of the way that we look at news events, or like any of the competing natural disasters that you see on television can be sort of mapped so neatly onto this largely racialized discourse of looting that it's a really interesting choice that the movie takes when the three individuals who are looting this gas station, one of them identifies that Haley is signaling for help underneath of the house across the street and then goes to intervene despite a lot of danger. Mm. The other one, who encourages him not to, doesn't do so in this sort of like calloused, like the three different individuals in the gas station represent this kind, an actual like kind of spectrum of individual. And it's not callous and it's not sort of like informed by what John just brought up, but it's more sort of like, I don't know, realistic. One of them goes to intervene because people often help people in situations like this. The other one advises the other one not to, not out of this like, ah, leave him to drown, Johnny, or like what the fuck ever. She does talk like that, exactly like that though. So that's in the movie. It was a weird choice. She encourages him not to out of fear. Mm-hmm. She's clearly afraid and nervous about what could happen. And it's just like, maybe it's nothing. She tries to explain it away as a way of protecting herself and protecting the person that she's with.
She says, don't do it. You're going to get shot.
Yes. Yeah. And that's so important.
Exactly.
And I think it's at this point too, where like the movie is kind of like pulling straight out of Anti-Oedipus. And I just like loved this little like wacky encounter here, because we have like, There's that like point where Deleuze and Guattari are like building off of Spinoza, and they're like, it's not weird that, I'm paraphrasing here to make it more relevant to the movie, but they're like, it's not weird that some people loot. It's weird that we all don't loot. And I think like this movie explores that in a way that I found to be really compassionate, right? Because the looters are both stealing food and snacks and chips, but they're also stealing an ATM, which is probably full of cash. And, you know, I think it would be tempting to read that as like there is this often really racist depiction of looters in media where they're like, oh, they're just stealing TVs and sneakers and just kind of like these things that are like heavily racially coded. But it's like, so what? So what if they are like, you know, like the working people of this world deserve everything, including cool shoes. And like in terms of the context of the movie, too, like, you know, like, you know, like what the idea that we mentioned earlier, too, that like, oh, like a lot of stuff is covered by insurance in terms of these extreme weather events, but decreasingly so. Like as weather events get more extreme, insurance agencies are starting to, you know, casually write that out of their policies. And if you're a renter, you know, like, or, you know, you're maybe like, you know, precariously housed, like you don't have shit if your building is destroyed by natural weather events. So the money in that ATM could literally be life or death in the wake of a hurricane this extreme. And I think like by showing them going to attempt to save people, you know, by putting them in this really like organic situation, it really does ask the question of like, oh, why are we all not trying to help each other? Like, why are we all not naturally on their side?
Yeah. I mean, you both have brought this up, which is like, actually, we know who suffers the most in a natural disaster, right? We know that when like the machinery of the state is put into operation, there will be, you know, there'll be states of exception will be enacted, right? Biopolitical laws will be, or procedures and mechanisms will be activated in order to categorize certain kinds of life as completely expandable. You know, it's the old, it's children, it's the non-white, it's the unhoused, it's the poor. And all of this is kind of driven home pretty spectacularly in how this ends for our reunited father, you know, we've reinscribed the Oedipal relationship between daddy and daughter, like everything's fine now that mom is out of the picture. Right? It's in a way that's deeply Freudian, but it's like it's all there in that final shot of like, you know, literally the deus ex machina comes down to save the good lower middle class white people.
Yeah, when the storm stops and they're like submerged in like in a chest deep water or something like that, and the sky opens up as this like, and then that's when the real racing starts, right? When order is restored, they're like, the idea that that relationship is outlined through the metaphor between a sports dad, a coach dad,
mm-hmm.
and his daughter is perfect.
Wow. Brilliant.
Genius. You can't be, like, as with every other aspect of this movie, you can't be more perfectly and painfully obvious.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. And it warms my heart. I feel like that's honestly what a good creature feature is for, is being able to do that.
All in 90 minutes or less.
Crisp and clean. Mm-hmm. I love it. We'll talk about an enjoyable film experience. Getting it in and getting done that quickly. I love it.
Any additional points? There's gotta be more hot takes within us.
Oh, there are. I mean, I'm just looking at our notes here and I'm like, there are an infinite series of hot takes. So John, I know you wanted to bring up the case for letting Malibu burn.
Yes. This is, as I said before we started recording, this is arguably one of my favorite essays ever, written by maybe one of the best, greatest American, like, socialist intellectuals of the last 50 or 60 years, Mike Davis, who, I miss Mike Davis. So Davis writes this basically in kind of Marxist ecology about fire season in California. And why people insist on building houses in the fire belt, and the ways in which this activity is actually making these fires increasingly more and more dangerous. And it's like, actually, we know why certain homes flood, and we know why certain houses have to be built in places that are at risk of flooding, and like, did anyone else get the, oh no, the levee has broken? Mm-hmm. And you're like, I don't know, maybe there's some class politics meeting some ecology of the Anthropocene here. I don't know. What do you both think?
Yeah, certainly. It fits in so neatly with, like, we can draw back to what is becoming, it's just becoming quite a collection of episodes. So I'm grateful to you both, sincerely.
All you.
The idea of Color Me Blood Red, where we talked about sort of like the commodification of the beach, mm-hmm. as this sort of like impeding territory of an idea. In the way that, like, because it doesn't just, like, now this is like the, this is like the critical theory show. So you get to have fun with everything and take it into this, like, this dimension of not just the way that the social world moves at the whims of not just the industry powering and powered by a particular class, but also the whims, desires and sort of constructed desires, if you will, of that particular class, and the often catastrophic, at the very least, very shitty results that it always has for literally everybody else in the world. Mm-hmm. And it, like, the thing that should probably concern people, I think, the most, besides what we just mentioned before, which is there's going to be, I would absolutely say, in the sort of intensity of natural disasters, you should expect this, just as John said, this identifying and particularizing apparatus to, you know, ramp up new ways of inscribing criminality on people for, you know, being outside and stuff like that. We're going to find there's always new ways to, if there's anything that I've learned over researching things for the past year, is that there's always new inventive ways to build these, like, connective nodes throughout this, using this particular idea. And that capitalism is very good at it. It's one of the things that it uses to very simply protect itself. So I guess on the other hand, the thought left me. The thought, on the other hand, the other hand left me. My other hand was bit off by a gator.
Oh no!
No.
Not your podcasting hand.
We're surrounded by gators all the time.
I mean, sometimes in a non-metaphoric way, we are surrounded by gators all the time. I think like my last parting thought and something that just came to me as the delicious. I don't know if I'm beset by gators as much as I'm beset by the rot from Resident Evil 7. You know, but I think that just kind of like crept into my spinal column as I was sitting here. But like, as I was watching this movie, I couldn't help but think of another horror film and how this movie had interesting parallels with it. And it's I Spit on Your Grave. Like this movie has so many interesting visual like overlays with I Spit on Your Grave. And then I was thinking, of course, listeners, and you can quote it with me, the classic Carol Clover line, you know, that I Spit on Your Grave is simultaneously a gendered underclass being oppressed by gendered overclass and then an economic underclass being oppressed by an economic overclass. Mm-hmm. And then I was thinking about this the same dynamic here, right? Because, you know, Haley's father is like woefully beholden to the alligator in the crawl space of his psyche that is patriarchy, right? Like that's the thing that ultimately endangers his daughter's life. If he would have sheltered, if he would have stayed with his phone, like, you know, his daughter wouldn't have had to drive into it, like, I guess, like, Florida's, like, highest alligator density housing district. Mm-hmm. And so we have like, again, like, those same, like, I Spit on Your Grave gender parallels and gender discourses emerging here. This kind of spillover, in this case, much less direct, but a spillover of the violence of the patriarchy. But then we also have this kind of, like, this ecologically subordinated alligator hurricane, like metaphor for what we're doing to the world around us, kind of, you know, like ravaging the edges of the human here. I think that the parallels there are really interesting.
Yeah, you've just brought to mind maybe my least favorite review of this movie, which was like someone going, actually, this isn't a horror movie about a big alligator. It's a horror movie about climate change, to which you can only go, well, that's a lib shit, because this is a horror movie about capitalism.
Yes.
But really, the next level down of the galaxy brain meme is, this is a horror movie about a giant alligator. but you're completely correct. But I think it's incredibly telling that there is this orthogonal relationship to something like I Spit on Your Grave, totally. But this is, again, it's mediated through this kind of like Oedipal psychoanalytic drama that is like exemplified and concretized in American sports films. Because mm-hmm. that's basically what it is, right? How do you repair your relationship with your dad who doesn't understand you? You have to wait until he's divorced. And you train really hard. Like that's really what this is about. And it's really, again, it's a shot quite naturalistically. And so when she first arrives at her dad's house, there's like a shot of like a bourbon bottle that seems maybe more empty than it should be. There's a prescription bottle for pills as well. And there's all of this kind of like domestic and reproductive labor that's implicit in this moment of I have to go check on dad because that's what you are quote unquote supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. If I have any complaint about this movie, it's that sequence, because I'm like, is this like a late Fallout game level of environmental storytelling? They're just like empty bottles and a little note that's like I'm never going to recover from this, just sitting there.
She did pick up the bottle of pills and shake it into the camera lens, which I thought was a really good choice.
She held up the envelope that had the red legal stamp that said divorce, and then the other one that said repossessing your home.
Yeah, I love the fact that it was like escrow on the big sign of his house, just in case you didn't get it.
I did think they crossed the line when they held up the one that said alligator great not repaired. I felt like that was a bit too much.
Yeah, when she picked up the pills and the narrative subjective voice from Disco Elysium said, ah, pills. And then she asked that voice a bunch of questions about what pills are. I thought that might have been over explaining it a little bit. I think we got it.
If you pause and you zoom in on the pills, you'll actually see that they're anti-alligator pills. So, if it, you know, again, like if her dad would have been taking those meds, it'd be fine.
Look,
you got to make sure you take your anti-alligator pills, because otherwise you might end up looking like the Black Knight from that Monty Python movie.
But you're fine. But like the Black Knight you're from fine. The Monty you're Python totally movie, fine. You're fine. Fine.
It's just a flesh wound. You're still going to be a swimming champion, even if an alligator has bitten your chest off, your arm off, your leg off. It's just a flesh wound. Fight me. You're not crossing the bridge.
Yeah. If anything, this it'll make you swim faster.
It's weight savings.
The attempts to kind of like reconfigure and like recapture a particular reality is it through the lived metaphor of being a sports daughter is in a movie where she is a Florida Gator dressed in Gator orange, running from Gators and then eventually swimming against other Gators, like she was at the 4x2 practice we saw at the beginning of the film. She begins the movie swimming against Gators students and then ends the movie swimming against. She is in a race with the Gators at the end of it. They are not, she is not, it is a race. I got distracted by that point and forgot what I was going to say.
Oh my God. That point's actually so fucking genius, because I will now point out who are her swim team competitors? Other women. What do we learn about the alligators in the crawl space is that they are a loving lesbian alligator couple. They are lady Gators. And so what we see here is, again, the patriarchy forcing women to fight against each other for its own benefit, i.e. the salvation of the father. Thank you for building that point up, Kyle.
No notes. Amazing.
That's the movie.
This is my favorite movie about lesbian alligators, that's for sure. Short list.
We have basically made a podcast which is almost the same length as this film.
Yeah, I want to thank the Serbia Creates Film Council, the Canadian Film Tax Incentive, the good state of Florida, and off-brand Florida State University merchandise for today's episode.
Also, thank you to James Wan for passing on directing this project and giving it to the French guy that made Piranha 3D.
Piranha 3D, yeah, oh, exactly.
Brilliant. Wise choice. Also, Sam Raimi. This is a Sam Raimi movie. I don't think we mentioned that yet, have we?
My guy gets it. I'll just put it that way.
He's got the juice. Sam Raimi has got it.
I like to think that he requested in his the way as we talked about earlier the way that we imagine this the heavy hand of Sam Raimi in this movie encouraged more Gator POV camera, which why we got as much as we did, which was still not enough. I mean, honestly, the whole movie could have been from the Gator POV camera, but that maybe was, you know.
That's Crawl Art House Edition.
4 hours long.
You heard it. Filmmakers.
We only get dialogue when the Gator gets close enough to somebody for us to kind of like organically hear it.
No non-diegetic sound. It's going to be perfect.
Yes. There's just like two lines, and one of them is, "Your mother deserves a better life."
By the sounds also, of it, that would be directed by Bellatar as well.
Interesting. Also, in terms of I think my real final thought is I could fix him. In terms of Dave the dad, I could fix him. That's all I'll say.
Oh, you 100% could.
Get him. Thank you. Just get him to take his anti-alligator medication. That would be a good first step.
This is anti-crocodile pillin. I mean, you know, in a way, we're all kind of trapped in the crawl space. You know, we're working through stuff. The crawl space is so. Oh God, I'm still just not over like how wonderfully like just just open and direct the metaphor of this movie is. It's just like there is no way to watch this movie and not get it. And there's something just beautiful about that.
The thing to think about is that the gators rarely crawl in this movie. They mostly swim.
Yes.
But, you know.
And they change size.
You go from crawling to swimming, you know. That's the myth, right? What crawls in the morning, swims in the afternoon, and races you in the evening.
Specifically, Gators. She's doing this too for her student loan debt, right? So in a way, the alligator is, you know, how just as John was saying earlier, how debt driven American society is. That's really the alligator in the crawl space of the mind.
That is better than the climate change thing. I will say that her chasing her student debt in an effort to keep her swimming scholarship would be better than the, that's a better take.
That basically makes us election pundits, given the year that we've discussed this movie.
Putting it on my CV.
Joe Biden, where do you stand on the alligators that can somehow magically swim up to the third floor of a lovely Southern Gothic home?
You do not want to ask Joe Biden what he thinks of the, quote, gator problem. He might revert back to some pretty nasty opinions.
I feel like that would get something out of, like his mind, though. That would jog a bunch of random sundowning memories.
Yeah, you find out, you learn a new crop of Irish slurs for alligators. I would like to know. I am curious.
I mean, what, alligators, green, Florida State University, orange, Haley wearing green and orange. It is 2024. Lieutenant Commander Data was right. This movie is about the reunification of Ireland. The alligator reaching the third floor, right? Right. That symbol getting up there, that is overcoming the unlikelihood of reunifying the closest colony to England.
I don't think
a key takeaway here. The fact that this is an international film is not lost.
I think that's the line we got to go out on right there.
Yeah. Okay. So. Oh yeah. So critical support to alligators and Sinn Féin. That's what we learned in the Sam Raimi movie. Every Sam Raimi movie is just the gift that keeps on giving. Oh well. Candy. Kyle. Thank you for joining us. And besides being the unofficial third host of Horror Vanguard, as I love it every time you get credited with that, it makes me so happy. Where can our listeners find you and your wonderful things and your stuff? Yeah.
Not nearly as happy as it makes me. well, thank you as always for having me. My eternal plug is the podcast All Gamers Are Bastards. We have some fun things planned for the new year as we're mapping out sort of our... we're mapping out 2024 in February, just like AGAB always does, 2 months late. But it's a great show. You can hear Horror Vanguard on there on two different occasions. So you should go listen to that. And you can find me at Labor Kyle on other things, YouTube mostly.
And links for all of this wonderful stuff are going to be down in the show notes, and I look forward, listeners, I hope you can sleep easy in your crawl space with your loving lesbian alligator parents. We will be back next week to discuss a movie featuring Commander Chakotay.
We hope you've enjoyed the Dread Discourse. Until next week, stay spooky.